We're at a brand new high school in Kansas City, and that little cowbell sound tells ninth graders it's time for class. Crossroads High School is in downtown Kansas City. Currently, only about 30 ninth graders attend, and they're camped out, for now, in just one hallway. So Principal Kirsten Brown didn't think she'd need a bell to start and dismiss classes. She quickly changed her mind. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll hear some new ideas about high school, starting with Principal Brown and her students. They're working on speeches about what they expect from a high school education.
You got this? Yeah,
who's going to give me the countdown?
Okay, I got you. Five.
No, you're counting wrong. It's 7, 3, 2, 4, 9.
7, 3, 2, 4, 9.
Crossroads. Crossroads is a rather new charter school to this district.
So because it's such a new school and we're building from the ground up, quite literally, we have to, you know, build all the infrastructure for our school in terms of our planning and developing systems and things like that. You can't plan for everything. And I think I've learned that. Students being tardy to class. I mean, that's like such a small detail, but we didn't even put anything in place. We talked about it broadly, but not like a clear system. So immediately went to the drawing board and created it.
15 seconds. 9. 8. 7 seconds.
So a lot of teacher time is spent planning for this year and next year. We have 2 Harvard fellows, which is excellent. So those are teachers who are doing their residency, try out Kansas City and see if they want to expand the program, which is really exciting. So those teachers are teaching our humanities course, which is a great hybrid of history and English.
Regular schools don't prepare students for public speaking. Furthermore, they don't teach them about the myriad of job opportunities that students can strive for inside and outside of their own communities.
Thank you.
So who has some affirming feedback?
I stutter over words. I stutter over them because I keep thinking I'm going to get them wrong. So I try to get them right, but just I can't say it in my mind instead it comes out of my mouth. So it kind of...
Yeah, I also think you had a couple words in there, too, that you weren't like...
100% confident. That's Miss Moana's fault. Her and her big
Ms.
vocabulary.
Said,
I thought yeah, having I think big words would make you sound smarter.
Like, I think it kind of takes educated. Away, at yeah. least from us, because probably. Since we don't really understand, like, so if you guys just learned these words, like, today or, like, a couple days ago, I think you should stick with what you had before, because then it makes... If you have simpler words, it flows out of your mouth.
We really believe in collaboration because that's when kids learn best, when they're sharing what they know with their peers and they're learning from their peers.
See, which one
this
is
one?
Not?
B-A-C-A.
But why?
Because the B is supposed to be in the middle.
Not necessarily.
Most schools have after-school clubs. What we're doing is we are partnering with as many community organizations as possible to make those come to life. You know, we had our very first ever athletic event yesterday. It was volleyball, which is great.
Scholars at Crossroads, due to being downtown, can receive a wide variety of opportunities and job internships to expand our amount of career paths. Getting the chance to be the first class ever at Crossroads High School is one hecking of an ego booster.
I didn't get no snaps.
I think you should change the word hecking.
Me too. I was thinking about
that. That makes your everything sound like all professional stuff.
That was the joke of it.
It wasn't funny though.
I don't know.
Is it slang that you're using?
He says it all the time.
Yeah, I do say it all the time. I just say hecking.
Okay, we'll talk. So what we're gonna do now is I'm gonna have you guys go back to Career Academy. We're going to see if there's time later at the end of the day where I can pull you for crew to get that extra practice in, so you get those at-bats,
okay.
Get more confident, and then tomorrow we'll continue with practice.
We should do this in front of our crews.
I love that.
That's just a little taste of what life is like at Crossroads High School, a brand new high school in downtown Kansas City. Ellie Moxley is our education reporter here at KCUR, and she gathered that sound on one of her many visits to the school. She's here with me now in the studio. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Gina.
So it seems like starting new high schools is becoming a thing in Kansas City. What's going on with that?
Right. So Crossroads is what, you know, kind of a popular charter school in the downtown area. They now have a Quality Hill campus as well for their K through eighth graders. And what we're seeing a lot of in Kansas City right now is these charter school systems in particular growing and expanding. You know, some of them are expanding down. They originally, you know, had fourth through eight, and now they're going kindergarten through eighth. Others are expanding up and they're adding these kind of high school classes. And, you know, Crossroads is one we've heard a lot about the very popular French Immersion Charter School Academy Lafayette, looking for a place for its new high school. And you see this kind of desire for charter schools in particular to build entire school systems, you know, a K-12 system, not just, you know, a elementary school or a middle school or a high school.
Talk to me about the gaps people perceive in the high school landscape as it is. I mean, theoretically, they're starting schools or talking about starting schools because there's something they want that isn't out there yet.
We know that in Kansas City, public school enrollment is kind of skewed towards the younger grades, that we have more kids enrolled in those kind of K through sixth grades than we do in the seventh through 12th grades. So we know that at some point families are making other decisions about high school for their children. We're not entirely sure where all those kids are going. You know, part of this is I think parents have, you know, kind of what they want. There does seem to be, while there is, I think, a growing interest in a lot of Kansas City's public charter schools, as well as some of the signature schools at Kansas City Public, I think there's some reluctance on the part of a lot of families to send their kids to neighborhood high schools. They feel like if they have other options, they'll send their kids to other options. So then they start thinking
just
about
people wanting other options.
I think it's people wanting other options. I think there are, especially when we're talking about middle class, affluent, more affluent families, you know, they are looking for schools where the demographics reflect their kids. There's some reluctance to send kids to white children to majority black high schools. I mean, that's a part of every conversation we have about schools in Kansas City is race. And they also have really specific things that they want. I think one of the big buzzwords right now is either STEM or STEAM education. So your science, tech, engineering, math, and sometimes we include arts in that as well. That's a big part of the conversation here in Kansas City right now. I'm sure everyone has seen the Uniting at Southwest flyers that are kind of around in neighborhoods. But I think it's a lot of families are thinking through, they want really specific things from a high school education. And if they're not finding that specific thing, they start kind of asking questions about, you know, hey, how do I get this thing? How do I get this school for my kid the way that I'd like the school to be?
The word innovation is one that we've heard it a lot in the entrepreneurial world in Kansas City for a long time. And now I feel like I'm hearing it more in conversations about education.
Yes, I think that's fair. I think that you hear the word innovation. I think it means a lot of different things. There's obviously a lot of ideas about schools that have been kind of floating around, or we've been talking more about how do we build schools that better prepare kids for, you know, life after their education, whether that's going on to, you know, college or a community kind of based education or some kind of career training, whatever that looks like. We're really starting to think about whether or not, you know, this kind of traditional high school experience really gets kids today, and kids that are much better at technology than any of us were when we were 17 and 18.
Or maybe than any of us are now.
That's true. That's certainly true. You know, so I think that that's part of it. I feel like this is happening very fast. I think you hear from teachers a lot that there's almost kind of a whiplash sometimes. We come up with these new ideas in education, or we come up with these innovative ideas, and some of them work and take root, and others of them kind of, you know, they run their course and then they get discarded after 2 or 3 years. And I think that's one of the hard things about being in education right now.
What's it like to actually be in a school where innovation is happening on the level that it is at Crossroads? I mean, they are reinventing the wheel with a bunch of 14-year-olds to wrangle at the same time.
Sure. And I think the biggest thing that you realize that if you spend a lot of time in schools, which I'm lucky to be able to do as part of my job, is that high school students are high school students. And it doesn't really matter what school you go into. They're still teenagers that are discovering themselves and trying to figure out where they fit in, not just at school, but kind of in the world. So that is a constant. But it is kind of interesting to be in a school where, you know, I went to a big public suburban high school, you know, and passing period was, you know, 2,000 kids squeezing through the halls, not 30 kids filtering between two classrooms. And because they're teenagers, they do still find ways to be late, which I think is humorous and kind of wonderful that they are still having that piece of that school experience. But I think one of the things that can be a little hard about being in school if you're not familiar with it, I feel like education has its own language and its own jargon. And I think that a lot of kind of what you hear in a school or as schools try out these new ideas is it actually might not be something that's totally unfamiliar to someone that's, you know, been out of school for a long time, but the way we talk about it has changed. And I think that's really one of the things to keep in mind as we talk about, you know, innovation in education.
So it's sometimes just new language. And yeah. Sometimes it's a substantially different idea.
Yeah, and sometimes it's having, you know, a specific way to talk about it. It's trying, you know, these very specific pedagogical approaches to education. You know, it's one of those things you kind of see that there is a difference, but it still looks like school.
Let's turn to Doug Thaman. He's with us from the Missouri Charter School Association, and he started a school once himself. Doug, tell me about that. What is it like to start a school from scratch?
Well, good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to be on with you this morning. Starting a new school provides an opportunity to really drill down and look at what are the needs of the students who are going to be attending, and building the school to meet their needs. And so, if the students are looking for a particular environment, a particular culture, community itself, you need to spend a lot of time listening to the community and what they're looking for is a certain model, then you have the opportunity to do that, and you have the opportunity to pull together a staff of high quality to create something unique.
Doug, you know, we have maybe not the clearest connection, so I'm going to put you on hold and we'll get that resolved. But I'm going to turn instead to Catherine Kirk-Kessler, who is also with us. And Catherine, you are a researcher who studies class and race in education. And I'm curious about what you make of the current interest in starting new schools.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Gina, and good morning, everyone. So what I think is really interesting when we talk about what is new in education, what's an innovation, and even what do we expect from high schools today is just to recognize first that in the history of U.S. high schools, from the moment when they first began to expand on a rapid basis in the early 1900s, there has never really been a generic or uniform high school experience.
Yeah, like maybe people, because of the age when they're in high school, all assume that what they experienced is the high school experience.
Exactly. And starting in the 1980s, a researcher named Jeannie Oakes, but then ever since going up to a recent book by John Diamond and Amanda Lewis, have really chronicled how the way we organize high schools in the United States is so fundamentally shaped by what's called tracking or these curricular differentiations that it's very difficult to talk about a generic experience, because based on where you're tracked in that high school, then it becomes a very, you're given
but
access
what does
to
that
different
mean, where you're tracked in that high school?
That's exactly what I was trying to study. I spent 2 years in a high school that's racially and socioeconomically, you could call it integrated. But then if you look at the, for instance, the higher level science courses versus the lowest level science courses, the teachers are all very concerned about the racial disparities they see there. So this was also
kind of racial disparities?
Absolutely. So the district was actually under a civil rights investigation from the DOE, and they were finding that you were almost 10 times as likely to be in a higher level science or math course if you were a white student in that district versus a black or Latino student. And so
even students going to all the same school are not necessarily having the same high school experience or getting the same thing out of it right now. So when we talk about expectations for the future, that's also something we need to consider.
Absolutely. And I think it's also helpful to keep in mind this bigger picture. So there's been a lot of reporting of Nicole Hannah-Jones's work on the resegregation between schools. And then this tracking is a part of the segregation that happened particularly strongly after Brown versus Board within schools, such that it really changes how you are perceived and then what kind of education you get offered. So, for instance, the difference between being seen as a potential scientist and the kind of curriculum you're given, the kind of opportunities you're given, versus being seen as someone who's not yet scientifically literate, and that these code words that we use, the language has changed over time. From the early 1900s, they were talking about immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe as not yet American and unscientific minds. And today we're talking often about the racial achievement gap, but a lot of the ways of sorting students and the kinds of education they're being given and the future possibilities that those allow are very similar to what was happening 100 years ago.
So this gets at who's doing the expecting when we talk about what we expect of a high school education. I mean, it sounds like maybe teachers or administrators don't necessarily expect the same thing for all students, and maybe not all students expect the same things for themselves for a whole lot of reasons.
Yes, I think that's part of it. And the other part I would say is it goes far beyond teachers and administrators, because if you look, for instance, at the next generation science standards, this is a U.S. policy for science education similar to the Common Core for math and literacy. There's a statement in there that basically says that in America, it should be possible, even essential, to lift the achievement of our low-performing, quote-unquote, at-risk groups, while at the same time elevating the ceiling for our future innovators. And what you see there is a dichotomy between who's assumed to be a future innovator and who's assumed to be an at-risk group. And those are producing very different kinds of educational opportunities.
Ellie Moxley, talk to me about this just from your own reporting.
You know, so we heard a little bit earlier, we were at Crossroads, the kids were getting ready to deliver, they were practicing these speeches that they prepared for kind of a charter school convention that was in Kansas City at the beginning of the month, and they were talking about their experiences at Crossroads and their expectations for their own education. And one of them was this fantastic young woman, her name is Amani Berry, and this is what she had to say about education.
A truly educated person can have a career, not just a job. Going to college introduces you to even more opportunities. In addition, what you learn in school relates to everyday life. Until I came to Crossroads, I never thought that I was going to be anything in life. The experiences that I've had at this school have taught me that all doors of opportunity are open to me as long as I have my education.
So she's talking a little bit about that her own expectations have changed.
Right. And I think you see this a lot, especially among, you know, kids who do come from these at-risk groups that, you know, they may not have examples in their own life. We talk a lot about, you know, the first in your family to go to college, those kinds of things. And, you know, I grew up in a house where the expectation was my parents had were educated and I was going to go to college. And our conversations about education never ended at high school. They were always about what happened next. And unfortunately, for a lot of kids, you know, this is a generational issue. There has been, there has been low expectations for years for different groups in society. And as a result, you know, if nobody kind of takes some of these kids up and tells them, hey, like, the ceiling is higher than you think it is and you can get there, I don't think it necessarily occurs to them. They model their own behavior on the expectations that are put for them.
What are your thoughts about that, Catherine?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And one of the things I would say is that a lot of research has demonstrated that the parents of Black and Latino students, who are often described as at risk, hold just as high expectations for their children's careers and futures as any other parents in this country. But the important thing to recognize is that a lot of times when we talk about choice and trying to follow what students are interested in, maybe career pathway wise, oftentimes there's systems in place at the high school level to use data to help students make a wise choice or make a realistic choice.
Well, what do you expect of a high school education? And do you think those expectations can be met by the schools in your community? We want to hear from parents, students, graduates. Call in with your wildest dreams for what a high school could be. 816-235-2888. We also want to hear your stories from what you've already experienced. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard, where we're talking about what people expect from a high school education. Call us and tell us whether today's high schools are meeting your needs, and if not, why not? We want to hear from students, parents, teachers, graduates. Share your experience and perspective at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with KCUR's Ellie Moxley and researcher Catherine Kirkessler. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hi.
And we're going to be talking with a couple of other people in a moment, but first, let's hear from a couple of students at Crossroads High School about what they expect from a high school education. They're giving speeches for an assignment. This is ninth grader Julia Bond.
Like Aristotle said, the roots of education are bitter, but the fruit is sweet. It can be hard to remember this, especially in high school. We get so busy with sports, homework, friends, family, and out-of-school activities that it is hard to stay focused on just learning during school.
And here's Anthony Hooper.
Hi, I'm Anthony Hooper. I'm the council president at Crossroads High School. As young, striving teenagers, we seek for the best school possible and want to gain education in the best way. At Crossroads, we're exposed to the atmosphere that is going to prepare us in more ways than just knowing how to divide a numeric shape into equal quantities and write a paragraph of the history of social justice. Thanks to Crossroads, we will prepare in life and grow as the young adults we are. Let's grow together. Let's be something great.
Doug Thaman, with us from the Missouri Charter School Association, what do you hear in these comments?
What I hear is a reflection of what we are told through research parents are looking for in their school. They're looking for a safe, secure environment. They're looking for a climate that is supportive of their children. And they're looking for coursework that is rigorous, but not just rigorous for the sake of being hard, but for the sake of really preparing their children for a future. And with the way the world has changed, we know that our children now are not, we're not preparing them just to compete with others in their neighborhood, for others in their community, for jobs. We know that they are competing against others around the country, around the world. And so there's a lot more at stake to really ensure that these students are ready to move into post-secondary life and to be prepared for the workforce.
So preparing students for their workforce, preparing students to be competitive, these are the goals of a high school education.
The goal of a high school education, in my opinion, is to ensure that those skills are starting to emerge and they're starting to develop so that as they enter into post-secondary education, then they continue to refine those skills. We hear now that the majority of jobs that students today will enter into as careers don't even exist yet. And we can't necessarily prepare specifically for certain fields or certain jobs, but we can make sure that the skills are there and the capacity is there to be successful.
You said that today's world is different, and I want to hear more about in what ways, like how those differences create specific different expectations. But also, we're not just talking about how things are different now. We're talking about how things will be different in the future. Like the future these kids are growing up into.
Right. And so that's where teachers, and I think somebody said earlier that teachers today, they're having to be more flexible and they're having to be able to pivot to meet changing needs. And so the instruction that they're providing 1 year may be very different a few years later because the needs of children, the needs of students are changing. And that's led to this focus on STEM and STEAM areas. And it's led to really needing to look at the instructional models to meet the needs of students. So if you look back in maybe times when we were in high school, there was a lot more direct instruction. It was a lot more of the teacher delivering the information and students receiving that information and through some rote practices, memorizing and preparing. Today, they need to be more engaged. They need to be more involved in the work they're doing, and they need to be able to learn how to be self-driven, how to be explorers in different fields.
Is that because education theory has changed, or is that because the world has changed?
I think it's because of both. I think the world has changed, and that's led to changes in education theory.
Let's talk to Gus Jacob. He's here from UMKC School of Education. And Gus, what are your thoughts on this?
I would agree. I think we need both, but schools are the ones that the change that we're not experiencing in school, I think, is a concern. Back to the comments about innovative schools, I guess I'm going to be the negative one, and I'm not seeing a lot of innovation in schools. I'm seeing a lot of the same thing kind of redone in a traditional way.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. Recently, there was an article about one of our suburban high schools that made a little change with their schedule, where students had about an hour during the day of unscheduled time where they had choices to do, whether they wanted to meet with teachers or just socialize or whatever. I think that's a move in the right direction. I don't think that's real innovation. I think we need to look at the entire schedule of schools think about how to make schools better.
So you're seeing small adjustments being treated as dramatic innovation?
I think so. I think one of the big concerns with high schools is this schedule that we try to put kids in, where they have 7 disconnected classes a day. They go from one class to another class to another class, and with a 4 or 5 minute passing period. I don't think that's the way we work as adults. I don't think that's the environment that kids should be in.
Well, let's get our callers in on this. When you call, you'll be talking to Gus. You'll also be talking to Doug Thaman with us from the Missouri Charter School Association, KCUR's education reporter Ellie Moxley, and researcher Karen Kirkessler. Hi, guys. These are the voices you'll be interacting with. And we're going to go now to Skip in KC North. Hi, Skip.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. How about you?
Fine, thank you. I just think our educational system is deplorable. I remember when I was in college, I was writing a paper on the decline in our educational system back in 1970s, and went back to some Newsweek articles and Time and U.S. News and World Report and read some issues on the fact that the Yale and Ivy League schools were having their freshman students do remedial English because they couldn't write a paper. And I think today it's even worse. How many of these children growing up and graduating from high school have at least a 20,000-word vocabulary? I don't think any of them do.
Well, Skip, what is your sense of what someone should get out of a high school education? And is there something that you think is really important to get out of it that maybe we haven't talked a lot about?
Well, command of the English language, for one thing. These kids graduating today have never probably diagrammed a sentence or taken a sentence apart and have any idea what a subject and a predicate are. And I think that a foreign language is also necessary for survival in the world economy the way we're shifting now, and nobody's stressing that.
Well, let's talk to some of our guests. Gus Jacob, what are your thoughts on, when I went to school, diagramming a sentence was part of what I learned. I am a huge nerd, so I loved it. But I'm not totally sure whether that is a skill that has helped me in life or not. I'm not the right person to say.
Nor am I. Do I believe that diagramming sentences is the answer to writing? I think the way you become a good writer is we read a lot and we write a lot. And it's done in an environment where individual is challenged to think at a deep level, because writing is an expression of thinking. And so our schools shouldn't create students that are just recipients of knowledge given to them. It should push them to think at a very high level, write about it, think about it, interact about it, and that's where good writing comes from.
So I write for a living, like a lot of folks here at KCUR, and my mother is an English teacher, and I was not taught in school how to diagram a sentence, yet I became a pretty good writer, a good enough writer that I am able to make my living today by writing. So I think it's one of those things that it's not that I don't understand, you know, what the noun is, what the verb is, where the adjective goes in a sentence. It's just that I feel like I was taught in a more kind of practical application way versus let's write a sentence on the chalkboard and diagram it and draw lines and draw arrows and label things. I think there's a lot of ways to get it done. And then the other thing I just wanted to say is, in general, people tend to have a more negative perception of schools than the reality is in classrooms. This has been going back 40 or more years now. I think the seminal case is kind of the A Nation at Risk report that came out in the early 1980s that said that American students were falling behind their peers in other countries. And actually, over the years, American students are actually doing all right. We're actually starting to close some of these achievement gaps that we talk about. We've actually seen some real progress from, especially students of color. So I think that there is this idea that kids are getting dumber and that their education is not, you know, sufficient. And I think part of that is a narrative that isn't necessarily true.
And maybe, I mean, when we talk about the world that these kids are entering, maybe the expectations in some ways are higher. But I'm curious about the how much stress there is in communities on kids emerging from high school with strong writing abilities. Doug Thaman, do you hear that?
I do hear that. And I think, you know, Skip raises a really good point, which is it's not only important for students and who become adults working in the workforce to be able to employ skills, so to become a good writer or to be a good writer, but there's also a lot of value in understanding why they are a good writer, because they understand the different pieces of grammar and how that works together. And so I think there is some balance there. And so we're hearing, when you hear from someone in the community saying, this is a need that our students have, we need to listen to that need. The other interesting point, I think, that I heard from Skip is around the vocabulary. And that really harkens all the way back to a strong early childhood education, that students who enter into kindergarten and they've had a strong early childhood education have a much stronger command of the English language and a stronger vocabulary. They know thousands more words than children who have not had that experience. And so when we're looking at the value and the way that we provide instruction in high school, we need to look at the entire education system. And that starts with making sure that we have a strong early childhood education to give these good kids a good foundation.
Let's talk to Eric in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
What do you want to share?
Well, I think that something that kids need to learn in high school is how to plan the cost and the benefit of what they're going to do with their educational choices in college. And I don't think that was ever done for me. I have a bachelor's degree. I work as a registered nurse, and I do very well, but I know other people with bachelor's degrees that have worked as hard as I have on their degree, that are working on a new degree or something else, changing career fields, because they just spent $50,000 on a degree that doesn't have any applicability to the workforce, and I don't think anyone ever told them about that. They shared the idea of education with them, and I also encountered people that are plumbers and tradesmen that instead of going to college, they go to trade school and they're educated and they get paid while they do it. And so they don't have the same debt load, the student debt load. And then they're making equivalent income to someone with a bachelor's degree or other things. And I think it would be a boon to our high school students if you say, look, this is what it's going to take. If you want to be a doctor, you're probably going to start making money when you're 30. You'll go $250,000 to $500,000 in debt. then you'll be underpaid during your 5 years of medical residency or 4 years. And then when you're a doctor, you'll make six figures depending on your specialty. And it'll take, more than 10 years to pay that back.
You know, Eric, thank you for that call. I feel like the real question here is, do we, as we change our idea of what a high school is, do we also need to maybe adapt how we think about and talk about what comes after high school and how we talk to kids about that? I'm going to start with you, Gus.
I certainly think so. High school diploma isn't enough. We talk a lot about that second piece of paper, whether it's a college diploma or a workplace certificate in some technical trade. And one of the things that I think some of the high schools are starting to do is they're starting to look at some serious college and career conversations by creating career pathways in the school where students, a group of students, are taught basically by the same teachers in a pathway that focuses in one area, whether it's engineering or art or health sciences. There's an organization in Kansas City that's helped a lot of schools do that. That's Prep KC, where they've actually supported that work and brought a lot of professionals into the schools, and with the goal to really embed the conversation about college and careers in the classes that the students are taking in the high school. So it's really a process of getting them ready. It's not just high school isn't the end. It should be really working towards that college and career initiative.
College and career, or college or career?
College or career, college and career, could be either one.
Catherine, I want you to jump in here.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the slogans we hear a lot, coming a little bit from the College Board College and Career Readiness Standards, but it's moving now into high schools, like, for example, the one where I did my research, and there's a language of we need to get all students college, career, and community ready. And so there's a sense there of trying to bring in some more holistic, some of the collaboration and things like that we heard in the earlier part of the program. But one of the dangers is all of those aspirations, which have been in part of our country for a long time, this egalitarianism that all students will be ready, are being layered.
And they'll be ready for the same thing.
Right, and that it's being layered on top of data systems now, which give students a particular impression of what would be realistic for them. And so there's, for instance, Lisa Delpit's talked about how basic skills are seen as at the bottom of a developmental trajectory towards more advanced, higher critical thinking, higher order thinking, this more advanced writing. But the danger is that what we count and test as basic skills or basic vocabulary are often very culturally specific. And so if you haven't necessarily had access to those particular words before, we may make a very dangerous assumption that you're not capable of doing some of the higher order thinking and the writing.
So maybe steering people in a direction based on a bias.
Right. And that the bias is not simply a psychological bias in the individual teacher, but that it's actually built into a lot of the theories and the tools that we use in schools every day.
Ellie, any final thoughts on this issue of like what people are expecting in this regard, in the regard of what high school is preparing you for?
You know, I think that there's always been a tension in education between practical skills and, you know, this kind of idea of teaching kids how to think, how to explore their horizons, how to have the tools so that they can use, you know, kind
enriching
of logic.
Them.
Yes. Like, I mean, you hear the term classical education. Like, it used to be that you went to college and you learned Greek and Latin and you read great scholars and you improved your literacy. And no, that is not necessarily a path forward unless you plan to be a scholar but that was what we thought it took to prepare people to, you know, be humans in the world.
Ellie Moxley, thank you for starting this conversation.
Thanks, Gina.
We're also joined by Doug Thaman of the Missouri Charter School Association, Catherine Kirkessler from KU, and Gus Jacob of UMKC. Now stay tuned for something totally different on KCUR Central Standard, coming right up. Let's drop in on Kansas City's own Psychotronic Film Festival, and just to set the scene, we're at the Holy Cow Market, a vintage store / music venue on Gillam, and amidst a sea of dusty old records and styrofoam pigeons, Matt Lloyd introduces a film.
This is the second film we've shown that was initially banned by its own government that co-financed the film. So that's pretty awesome. So everyone getting excited for dreamlike views on mental health and anti-authoritarianism. Buckle in!
I'm Gina Kaufman, this is KCUR Central Standard, and now we're going to find out what psychotronic film is and who is watching it for fun in Kansas City. Our guest is one of the co-founders of that series who goes by the name Jacqueline Danger. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, Gina.
So the theme of that night we popped in on was Polish invasion. Sounds obscure, but it also sounded like a very enthusiastic crowd.
Well, it is. It's not really a showcase that you get very often in Kansas City, and so that's something that we always try and bring to the screen on the Psychotronic Film Series, is especially with foreign films, showing like the best of the offbeat and rare foreign films that don't often get viewed in Kansas City.
What is psychotronic film?
So psychotronic is a little bit more encompassing than, let's say, the genre of cult, where it's any films upon their actual release. They were not very well received by critics at the time, but then since then, they have had gained a cult-like following, and they have a big, phenomenal presence in the filmmaking community. But they're pretty unheard of.
Can you give me an example, one that maybe especially delighted you?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I would say the film The Mask from 1961. It's a rare Canadian horror film that is just, like, phenomenal in terms of being very surreal, very imaginative, and most people have never even heard of it.
What is it about?
It's about this ancient artifact that this man finds, and it's this haunted mask. And when he is compelled to put it on, it transforms into this hallucinatory nightmare landscape that starts consuming him to murder people.
Whoa. And so just from an aesthetic standpoint, is there anything going on like that enhances that plot?
Upon its creation, it's actually in 3D, and so in the film, it has this great moments where it compels the audience to also put on the mask, which they're these wonderful skull-like 3D glasses.
Whoa.
So then you are transformed into the world that he is also going into, and there are these incredibly weird, trippy 3D sequences. And so when we actually screened that film, we also created our own skull 3D masks to make it more fun.
What made you think that this genre was something that people either would be into or should be into?
You know, we actually, there's quite a few, like, hardened film lovers that are very much into psychotronic film. And, you know, when Matt and I thought in 2014 that we wanted to start doing this film series and starting the Cannonball Horrors screening collective, we really wanted to bring to screen all these films that we loved that just weren't getting any screen time within our local theaters.
So are most of these fairly recent releases, or are you looking back pretty far?
Almost, I would say 90% of everything we show is from the late 60s to mid 80s.
It seems like a golden era of a kind.
It was.
So give me another example of a movie that, like, just blew your mind.
You know, there's a lot of films out there that are totally fantastic. And so, like, we've then, like, since then have been trying to then do monthly themes so that we can encompass a way for people to actually like engage with the cinema. You know, we are big lovers of trash cinema, and so we were very proud to show Fateful Findings. It's one of like the most absurd, weirdest visions that you'll ever experience out there.
Tell me more about the weirdness of the vision.
There's a character that we fondly call Ghost Legs, who really is plot premise leads to nothing and just leads you more confused. A lot of people after watching the film often shriek in terror about why they watched that film.
What? Okay, so this brings me to the question of when you talk about trash cinema and liking sort of the weirdness of these movies, is it because they're so bad, or is there something really good worth not overlooking?
Yeah, everything that we've ever shown, like, we stand by that these are actually, there is a lot of incredible artistic credit to them. Like, even if they are, like, wonderfully bad. They are made with such passionate purpose that that really shines through in the film. And that's what makes it the kind of genre of so bad it's good. But it's there is credit to watching them. And they are extremely fun to watch.
Can you think of one of these movies where, like, on the face of it, you're like, oh, man, this was just silly and hilarious, but where you thought about something like a point that was made or an idea that came across in a really meaningful way later?
Totally. I would definitely think of just most likely I would say like anything that we program definitely has a lingering feeling afterwards. Like once you can sit on it and let it gestate within you, you really come across like being like, wow, like even though that movie was totally weird and bizarre, like I've really come home thinking that it's got this big epiphany of a moment that I'm now chewing on.
What are some of the themes that you've done?
We've done some repeat themes like Decadent Demolition or Satanic Panic. That's our current month that we're in right now. We've done Sophisticated Smut, Canuxploitation, Fascist Americana.
Did you say Canuxploitation?
Yeah, those are Canadian exploitation films.
I did not know that was a genre.
Well, now you do.
Tell me more.
I would say they're any type of exploitative film that is created in the great country of Canada.
For example?
There's this great little film called Things, and it is shot within a house with a couple of friends, and I would say buckets and buckets of blood, and it'll it feels kind of like you're losing your mind while you're watching it. It is quite fun.
Is Canada like a hotbed of this kind of movie? Is that why there's a whole category for it?
No, we just happened to find quite a few films that were really off the beaten path and that we wanted to, we thought that our people who come to any of our film series would really get a kick out of them.
Who are the people who are coming to your film series? I mean, I recognize that you are not going to like name them one by one, but it sounds like there is a little community out there, and I'd like to understand more about who's in it and what it means to people.
Yeah, I feel like we've sort of gained quite a cult following of people who are really like excited about being cinematic adventurers. Like as a collective, the Cannonball Roars really try and promote the archiving and appreciation of obscure films and also build upon our community's love for unique cinematic experiences. So it's really a type of person who's willing to take a chance to get out there, rather that be our Psychotronic film series or our Secret series, like the people who come
to Secret this series?
Yeah, so
not so secret now.
Well, still secret. I guess after we do them, they're not that big of a secret. But it takes like a certain person who's, you know, willing to get off their couch and stop watching a film inside their home and go out into, oh, you know, maybe like a drain or like a under the bridge or somewhere really weird and bizarre that's not that comfortable quite often. And there's not really a bathroom very often either. But, you know, they're out there because they love cinema.
So you hold these in different locations?
Yeah. So the Secret series takes then the film-going experience outside of the theater and then places it into the urban core of our city. And so with the goal that the setting matches then the subject of the film to create a more immersive experience.
So tell me about a pairing that really worked.
Man, there's so much. So, they've really turned into these platforms for multimedia collaboration between film, musicians, performers. You know, they're truly just these really playful and adventurous transformative events. So we had Secret Series Phantom that we had in this like really great drainage tunnel that we decorated. It'd be this haunted house tunnel that you pass through all spooky after you got dropped off by the Phantom Cab, which is kind of like a haunted Uber. And then you emerge from the drainage tunnel.
So the cab picked people up somewhere and took them to a drainage pipe.
Yeah. So it's this mysterious tunnel that's decorated like a haunted house with spooks and ghosties. And when you emerge, we have our screen right outside in this kind of creek bed. And we had an experimental live score by the King of Herrings and Piper Harrows that remixed cassette tape recordings on site to a custom edit of The Phantom of the Opera from 1925 and 1929.
Okay, like that is not just an elaborate experience, but it's a lot of work on your end. Why? I'm not asking this because I think it's not worth it, but what makes it worth it to you?
What's really fun? It's not happening in our city. And so Matt and I often were just like, well, let's make it happen. We have these dreams, and then Matt makes my dreams come true, and then we pull it all together with these large-scale collaborations. Like, they're definitely not just Matt and I's effort. They are quite a bit of people from our artist community collaborating with us.
You know, you mentioned that it's for people who want to take a risk, and it seems like just such a different attitude toward watching a movie than I'm going to look up the reviews of the big things that are out now, read 7 reviews, make my wise decision. Can you talk a little bit about that difference in attitude?
You know, I really think it just takes the type of attitude where you want to get out there and immerse yourself in a really unique experience. And if people are looking for more experiences coming up, we've actually got a showcase this Friday where we're bringing the Eye Slicer Roadshow to Kansas City. It's going to be at the Last Smut House, the Strand Theater. It's on 3544 Troost Avenue at 9 p.m. It's hosted by a robot. It's in Smell-O-Vision. There's free milk and cookies. We're going to have roller skating eyeball people, and it's going to be a hell of a weird time. So if you'd like more information on that, you can go to our website at cannonballroars.com or facebook.com/psychotonicfilmseries.
Our time is up. Jacqueline Danger, co-founder of the Cannonball Roars Psychotronic Film Festival, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation and our earlier discussion about what we expect from high schools at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have everything ready for you later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can talk to us anytime on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman.